The case of United States versus Berg, 183250.
Judge Lucero, and may it please the court. My name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm with the Kansas Federal Defender's Office. I represent the appellant, Mark Berg. When we drive our vehicles, it is virtually impossible not to commit a traffic violation. And when we inevitably commit a traffic violation, the Fourth Amendment permits an officer to conduct a traffic stop. The Supreme Court held in Rodriguez against United States that a traffic stop's duration is limited to the time necessary to address the traffic violation that warranted the stop. So, if we inadvertently cross the fog line while trying to set our cruise control after just leaving a rest area on Interstate 70, an officer who pulls us over should do so to address that traffic violation. And only if that officer develops a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity should that officer haul us out of our vehicles.
Mr. Hansmeyer,
yes.
It's very apparent that your biggest problem in this case is with the issue of the, I'll call it the caravan issue.
Okay.
This was a drug caravan. That's your biggest problem, right?
Sure.
Tell me why that is appropriately to be analyzed as innocent behavior rather than an indication of a drug caravan.
So I'm not sure that we would even go. I think our position on that testimony is that it doesn't rise to the level of reasonable suspicion. I don't think it's something that, I actually think the district court, the fact that it considered the evidence was not a problem. We think it just gave it too much weight, if that makes sense. So essentially.
Okay, but tell me why.
Right, okay.
It from a factual standpoint, mm-hmm. it if you weigh the facts, it's more consistent with innocent behavior.
Right. So, and if you've had a chance to watch the video, I think it helps to watch the video to see how this took place. From our perspective, the vehicles, this tandem driving, was not, it wasn't more than a hunch of criminal activity for a number of reasons. One, it's not uncommon, we don't think, in this particular circumstance, to see three vehicles with out-of-state plates leaving a rest area on the interstate. I mean, I think it is, we would expect to see out-of-state people at rest areas. When you get into the rarity of out-of-state, of certain cars on the interstate, this court's decision in Martinez just addressed that's really not something that this court should consider.
What about the interaction of the three vehicles?
Yeah, right. So I think our basic point on this is that neither the trail vehicle nor the lead vehicle did anything. I mean, the baiting tactics here are one vehicle went 65 miles per hour and the other one went 10 miles over the speed limit. That's it. I think when you look at the cases on baiting tactics, you see cars doing things much more severe than that. And you see that because if you're trying to bait an officer away from a certain vehicle, you would think you would do more than go below the speed limit or just above the speed limit. And on the trail vehicle, I think, is interesting because this vehicle just leaves the rest area and an officer pulls out. You can see in the video the trooper pulling out next to him. The idea that vehicle's not going to speed up makes all the sense in the world to me because the officer's right next to him. I mean, we typically don't speed up beyond an officer when we're on the interstate, so I don't get that. And when you time, the other thing is when you look at there's this testimony that he was keeping, the trooper says these cars were keeping me away from the minivan. Well, that's...
Or what?
Were keeping me away from the minivan, like pulling me away from the minivan.
Okay.
And that is just, it's implausible. When you look at the video, it takes the officer less than 30 seconds to drive up to the minivan after he spends a good 45 seconds to a minute sort of driving alongside this trail vehicle. Within a half a minute, 45 seconds, he's up by the minivan. So if the whole purpose was to pull him away from the minivan, he didn't do a very good job.
If I may, please.
Yes.
But that's not what we're here about on this appeal, correct? It's not the initial stop
that you're appealing. I understood your appeal was that the detention was unreasonable.
Well, I think
Is that correct?
It is, but I think we're talking about this because this is the one thing the district court, other than the contents of the minivan, that the district court relied on.
It seems to me that if a car is stopped, and it was stopped without reasonable suspicion of the commission of a traffic violation, and you appeal that, that's what you're arguing now, then we need to consider that. But I thought we were past that, and that you were not challenging the stop, that you were challenging the detention. Am I wrong? Are you also challenging?
I'm not challenging the stop. And Judge Soseriff, if you want to say that the escort testimony only goes to the stop and not the search, that's fine with me. I mean, that's great. If you want to ignore all of that testimony, let's do that. That's fine.
Well, I thought it went to the stop, but maybe the U.S. attorney will tell us why it goes to the reasonableness of the detention.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, if I may, on the reasonableness of the detention. At some point, the officer said, "All right, thank you for your stop. You are free to go." Did that happen here?
Yes.
At some point, he was said, "You're free to go." From that point forward, how much time elapsed? That you contend is the subject matter of our review.
It took 30 minutes to get the drug dog there, so maybe a little more than 30 minutes.
So you're saying the half hour was the unreasonable detention?
Yes.
All right.
All right, can we get back to where we were?
Sure.
We're talking about going along the highway. You've addressed the trailing vehicle. And it just takes 45 seconds, you said, get up to the minivan, then continue on as you were going.
So the lead vehicle, what's interesting about that is if you watch the video, there are two cars. The minivan is bunched with two other cars, the one he's calling the lead vehicle and this other vehicle. What happens is the other vehicle speeds up and passes and gets in front of the lead vehicle. So the only way that lead vehicle accelerates is if that other vehicle accelerates. So it's not even true that this lead vehicle took off when Berg committed the traffic violation. In fact, both vehicles took off. What else is interesting about this is that the only one who did something that was suspicious was Berg. Berg was the one who hit the brakes a few times and went off to the side of the road. I mean, if there was any bait tactics going on, you would think it was the minivan. So I think when you consider the
Which would be stupid.
Exactly.
If that's the drug car.
Exactly. Right. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, and then it takes the officer even less time to catch up. If you watch the video, when he leaves the minivan to go run the lead vehicle's information, it's like 20 seconds, and he catches up.
But why isn't the acceleration of the lead vehicle a bait to detract attention from the minivan?
I guess you can call it that, but he's going 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. Who doesn't do that?
I've always been told to only go five miles over the speed limit.
But at the same time, there are two vehicles who are doing this, not just one. I mean, that's our basic
point. So is that the trail vehicle also speeds up?
No, there's an entirely separate vehicle.
Okay, that is not in this caravan.
Well, according to the officer, it's not. But the officer's testimony was essentially, I see what you're talking about on the screen as we're watching this, but I have no recollection of that vehicle. And I can't tell you why I didn't think it was part of this caravan.
But his recollection is being refreshed by showing the video in the district court, right?
I mean, it is, but he still has no recollection of the car. Like he doesn't have any reason why he didn't think this car was associated with the other ones. I mean, when you watch the video, this is just a Saturday night on Interstate 70 where you have traffic driving down the interstate. Well, and to the extent that this officer wants to infer these things, I don't think it's a strong inference.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hansmeier. Assume that this panel says, the packing of the vehicle is just so inconsistent with our decision in Karam that really here there is only one factor to look at, and that is the caravan issue.
Yeah.
Is it sufficient that you have only one factor
right.
for reasonable, articulable suspicion?
I mean, I would love to say no. I don't know that that's right, though. Okay. I think you could have a very strong one thing happens that is super suspicious.
Let me ask you this. Do you think then if there is only one factor versus multiple factors, that factor better be very strong? Is that your position?
And I think my position is even stronger than that when you have factors that dispel suspicion. Because here, I mean, we can count the ways, the things that should have dispelled suspicion. There's no nervousness. There's no criminal history. He's properly licensed. His license is a Minnesota driver's license, which is consistent with his story. He has proper rental papers. Those rental papers are consistent with his story. He promptly pulls over. Trooper doesn't smell drugs. There's no masking agents. There's no cell phones, no pagers, nothing in the vehicle. When you talk about his travel plans, you look at this court's decision in Lopez, Wood, Karam, White. These things that the officer says are suspicious are not suspicious under this court's precedent. You can rent a minivan. You can fly somewhere and drive a minivan back, and that's not suspicious.
And you're going to this issue. Well, one thing I've been struggling with in this case is the district court's decision, and I've unpacked that many, many times. And here's what I'm wondering. You know, usually we look very closely at the factual findings. Mm-hmm. And there are findings by the district court that support the factors that it did not rely upon. Mm-hmm. It made findings about the rental car, made findings about expression, whether he lived in Las Vegas or not, and these other factors. And yet he said those are not part of an articulable suspicion. When we look at this case on appeal, does that mean that we should similarly discard all those things?
Well, let me answer this and then reserve the man my time. I think what the district court did in this case is exactly what you did in your decision in Crum. I think he took the factors individually and then in the aggregate, and there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think there's anything wrong with determining certain factors just are not suspicious. I think when you look at this court's precedent, that's exactly what this court does.
Okay, but my question is, do we give any deference
I got you.
To the district court's discounting
yeah.
everything other than the way the cargo is packed and this caravan issue? Do we give
well,
that
your review is de novo. I think this rate, I mean, you're raising the most favorable light thing that we keep talking about in our briefs in this court, that precedent is wrong because it has to be wrong, because when you have a situation like this where the district court weighs certain factors in favor of the defendant, you can't weigh that. You should be weighing that just as you weigh anything else. So my answer is you as long as those facts are not clearly erroneous, you take them for what they are, and you weigh them when you do your de novo standard of review as you see fit.
Part of the problem is the articulation of the district court. It mixes the word credible,
okay.
with the word fact, and then discounts all these other factors. And I was wondering if that then makes the utterances on those factors more like findings of fact rather than conclusions of law regarding articulable suspicion.
I don't know that they're factual findings. I think what the district court did is consistent with this precedent, and that is the reason why you would also do what he did. That's our position. Thank you. I'll reserve the remainder of our time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Brown for the United States. Your Honors, we'd like to start out by pointing out something that the Supreme Court said. And that is that the evidentiary standard for reasonable suspicion is considerably less than a preponderance of the evidence. That's what the court said in Socolow and Arvizu. Furthermore, in finding reasonable suspicion, the officer doesn't have to rule out innocent conduct. Reasonable suspicion, the finding of reasonable suspicion, is completely consistent with innocent conduct. And furthermore, this court said in McHugh that reasonable...
What does that mean? That everything the chap was doing is innocent. He's walking down the street, but that's not, that's inconsistent with reasonable suspicion. It seems to me it's consistent with reasonable suspicion.
Well,
I don't understand that.
This court may have cleared that up in McHugh. In McHugh, the court said that reasonable suspicion can exist even if it is more likely than not that the individual is not involved in criminal activity. So even if it's more likely that the individual's activity is completely innocent, you can still have reasonable suspicion. You don't need the reasonable suspicion factors together to predominate over the factors consistent with innocence. In other words, a finding of reasonable suspicion is a very low evidentiary standard. It doesn't have to dominate over factors over a finding of innocence.
Mr. Brown, let me direct your attention to the second factor. As I understand it, the court said there were basically two factors that established articulable suspicion, and that is the caravan issue and the cargo issue. As to the cargo issue, how do you distinguish United States versus Karam?
Your Honor, we distinguish Karam on several grounds.
Right.
The main ground is that in Karam, the officer didn't use his common sense or experience based on human interaction or his experience as an officer to conclude that the cargo was suspicious. The officer, as this court stated in Karam, concluded that the cargo was suspicious based upon a single anecdote by another trooper who performed a stop in another case. That was his basis for concluding that it was suspicious. Here, on the other hand, this trooper looked to his common sense and ordinary experience, which he's allowed to do. He looked to his experience as a trooper with the motoring public and said, wait a minute, this cargo where the defendant said he's moving household items across the country, I don't see any household items. This isn't how people normally move. So in this case, the officer used his common sense, ordinary experience, as his experience as an officer to conclude that that was suspicious. In Karam, the officer did not use any common sense or experience. He just relied on an anecdote. So, in other words, in Karam, there wasn't any basis for the officer's conclusion.
Do you have any other basis to distinguish Karam?
Yes. In Karam, the officer thought the cargo was suspicious for the reason I just stated. The reason that because of the conduct of an officer in another case. Here, the officer did not think the cargo was suspicious. He thought that the defendant's story about moving items across the country was suspicious because the nature of the cargo and how it was packed did not match that story. So in other words,
cargo. You do agree, don't you, that the excuse that was given in Karam or Karam was the same excuse that was given in this case, and that is they were moving household goods. In Karam, they were moving the household goods of a niece. Here, this gentleman's moving his own household goods. So they sound like they're the same excuse, and it was not accepted in Karam, but it was accepted by the district court here.
Well, our answer to that is, in Karam, the court decided the case on the basis that the officer's inference was unreasonable, on the basis that he was simply relying on the anecdote of another officer who did another stop in another case where similar cargo existed. Here, that's not the case here. This court in Karam didn't reach the reasonableness of the officer's inferences about whether the items, the nature of the cargo pack, matched the items. The officer didn't think the cargo was suspicious here. He thought the cargo and the manner it was packed was suspicious in light of the story the defendant gave. That didn't happen in Karam.
All right. Why don't you go on? Do you have other bases to distinguish Karam besides two you've already recited?
Those are the grounds, and we put all those grounds in our brief.
Well, let me ask this. As I said, I did a lot to unpack this district court decision. In ruling that it was an appropriate factor, this cargo issue, to support articulable suspicion, Do you find it curious that the district court did not even reference Karam?
No, because we think Karam's distinguishable. It didn't have any controlling weight in the analysis. And in here, we don't think Karam stands. Well,
don't
for
you the think that, that the court is at least obligated to say why Karam is distinguishable?
You know, it. We think the court was obliged to look at the circumstances, apply the standards for reasonable suspicion, look at what the officer testified to, and figure out whether that testimony
matched. Okay, I
understand. Matched.
I'm talking about Karam.
Okay.
In the district court decision, it is given 7 reasons by the prosecution why there's articulable suspicion. The court relied only on number 1, caravan, and number 2, this cargo issue, correct? And in addressing the cargo issue, it never cites Karam. Then as it goes down to the factors 3-7 that it says does not establish articulable suspicion, as to the rental car, it cites Karam. Now, isn't that odd? It doesn't cite Karam in the cargo issue, but it cites Karam on the rental car issue?
Yeah, I can't speak for what was going through the court's mind.
Did you handle this in the district court?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I can't speak for what was going through the district court's mind, but what I can say is that we don't think that Karam stands for the proposition that when an officer sees cargo that doesn't match a story, then that's not a fact in reasonable suspicion. Karam stands for the proposition that an officer cannot rely on a single anecdote based upon a trooper stop in another case where he found similar cargo as the basis to find that cargo suspicious. It's a much more limited holding. So we think it's distinguishable. We explained that in our brief at length, and we stand by the explanation. Now, the court raised, if I may move on to sort of a different issue the court has touched upon, the court raised the issue of what do we do with these other factual findings in the district court and throwing out you know, 4 of the 6 factors.
So you're addressing my question is, how does this court deal with the district court's decision of eliminating those other factors?
Right.
I would love to hear you on that.
Here's what you do. You look at United States v. Wesby on page 588, and Wesby makes clear that this court, the district court, made 2 glaring errors. The first error was, number 1, to throw out from the totality of the circumstances analysis the innocuous factors. You can't do that. That's what the district court did. The court threw out or dismissed the innocuous factors or the factors consistent with innocence. You can't do that. That's what Wesby says. Number 2, Wesby says you cannot analyze the factors in isolation from the remaining factors in the totality of the circumstances. And that's what this court did. That's what the district court did. The district court said, oh, rental car? That doesn't mean anything. Well, the court could have very well said that of any factor that this court has talked about. Air freshener? Oh, that doesn't mean anything. The court could have said that with anything. So the court made 2 errors. So to answer Your Honor's question, what should this court do? This court should issue an opinion citing Wesby and saying this court made 2 errors in its analysis. Number 1, it threw out factors, it dismissed factors from the totality of the circumstances that were consistent with innocence. And number 2, it analyzed the factors in isolation from the totality of the circumstances. Then we think the court puts all the factors back in the totality of the circumstances where they belong, and then this court analyzes them in toto, as Wesby says you're supposed to do, and then this court makes a ruling under de novo review that reasonable suspicion exists. So the short answer to the question is, the court puts all those factors back in the totality of the circumstances analysis and analyzes their suspiciousness as part of the whole package of factors. That's what this court should do. We're confident that when this court does this, and when the court...
We understand every word you've
said. When the court does this, then the court will find that reasonable suspicion exists because this court's case law is amply supports all the factors that we've cited in our briefs. Now, if I could just move on to one other point. Please.
Move on to my
please.
Point. Okay. Why is the explanation from Mr. Hansmeier of why the caravan issue is more reflective of innocent conduct or neutral conduct rather than conduct of guilt?
Well, our answer to that is 2 things. Number 1, under the reasonable suspicion standard, as I mentioned at the very beginning, the officer is not required to rule out innocent conduct. Innocent conduct can form the basis for reasonable suspicion. So even if it is innocent conduct rather than suspicious conduct, it can form the basis for reasonable suspicion. That's exactly what happened in the Socolow case, where you have all these different factors for drug trafficking. The guy was taking a plane to Miami on a 48-hour flight. All those were consistent with innocence, and the court found reasonable suspicion. The same with Arvizu. Every single factor was super, super weak, and the court still
found... I don't understand it. Judge Ide is walking down the street. She is carrying a briefcase. She is on the way to her place of employment. Her hair is the way you would expect a pedestrian's hair to look. Her clothes...
No, it isn't. It is much better than that.
Her clothes are the way you'd expect a pedestrian to look. Everything is innocent. She could be arrested because the everything of the appearance of innocence can equal suspicious conduct. No. There has to be suspicious conduct independent. It has nothing to do with the appearance of innocence. Suspicious conduct has to stand on its own. So in this case, you'd have to have all of that is irrelevant. The point is, what's she done that's suspicious?
Well, the court hasn't articulated any factors that could be deemed suspicious under
well,
the totality
right.
of the
I
court
haven't
is
because
given. She's just
I
walking down
test
the street.
Your theory of the fact that 0 + 0 = 1.
Well, the better test of the theory is looking at the Socolow case and the Arvizu case, where all the factors were facially innocent. Every single one of the factors was facially innocent in both of those cases. And especially in Arvizu, one of the factors was the children were waving mechanical-like from the back of the van with their knees elevated, and the court took that to be odd and supportive of reasonable suspicion, and the fact that their knees were elevated was supportive of the suspicion that their knees were elevated on top of cargo. So
what does that have to do with innocent conduct? That was conduct that the officer determined to be suspicious.
In light of his training and experience.
That's right.
What happened
but
here.
It has nothing to do with the innocence of the conduct.
Well, it just goes to show that an officer can find reasonably conduct suspicious that is facially
so
innocent.
So I want to ask you about the issues of this case. Did the officer give his customary, I'm not going to issue a ticket, you're free to go, or vice versa?
He didn't tell him he was free to go. He handed him the ticket, and then the defendant started to open the door. And then the officer said, can I ask you some more questions?
And at that point, from that point forward, it was a 30-second delay, correct? Detention?
Well, at that point...
Did I say second? 30-minute detention?
At that point, we say the encounter was transformed into a consensual encounter when he said, can I ask you some more questions? And the defendant agreed. And then the reasonable suspicion part of the encounter starts when the officer says, I'm going to detain you while I get a drug dog. And that lasted 30 minutes. We're not really not fighting about... whether that was a consensual encounter or a detention.
Well,
after.
You're not, but the defendant is.
I didn't take it that way, but that doesn't appear in their briefing.
How do you understand the issue that we're supposed to decide in this case?
Excuse me?
Well, what do you understand the issue that we are supposed to decide in this case?
The issue is whether the time that transpired after the trooper called for the drug dog to arrive on the scene until the drug dog alerted was a detention supported by reasonable suspicion.
All right. And in support of the reasonable suspicion, you advance in your answers to Judge Murphy the fact that the boxes didn't look like moving boxes.
Correct? Correct.
Anything else?
Yes. We say that we have the escort vehicle conduct that includes conduct. We say that the defendant was driving in a rental car. This court in Davis says that driving in a rental car is supportive of reasonable suspicion. The defendant was traveling at night. This court said in Farmer that traveling at night can be supportive. The defendant was taking an indirect or unlikely route of travel. He was taking a route to Minnesota that was longer than the normal route, especially since he was in a hurry, and he was driving on I-70. Those are the factors.
Okay.
And the court needs to put all those factors back in the totality of the circumstances and consider those factors de novo.
All right.
I have one question. Mr. Brown, Mr. Hansmeier responded to a question of mine about a hypothetical. What if this panel decides there's only one factor to consider here, and that is the caravan issue? I want you to consider the same thing. And Mr. Hansmeier says, if it's a one-factor reasonable articulable suspicion case, then that one factor has to be a very strong factor. Tell me why that's wrong and why it would not be determinative when you tell me that part of the caravan issue could be interpreted as innocent.
And so
if part of it can be interpreted as innocent, doesn't that make that a less strong factor?
No.
Right.
Number one, just because it could be interpreted as innocent, we really don't see that as derogating from its suspiciousness, because the officer is not required to rule out innocent conduct, which is what our visu says. The court can look at a factor that's facially innocent as suspicious, and there's no contradiction there. Number two, the court asks, well, what sort of evidentiary standard do we need if there's only one factor? Here's the standard. It's considerably less than a preponderance of the evidence. So the question becomes, is the escort vehicle's theory alone, is that enough under the evidentiary standard, which is considerably less than a preponderance of the evidence to sustain reasonable suspicion? We say that it is, because although could be construed as innocent, it could also be construed as criminal. And it is construed as criminal in light of the officer's training and experience, to which we are supposed to defer. And when we do that deference, when we defer to his training and experience, that his ability to distinguish between innocent, suspicious circumstances, we think we have enough to meet that considerably less than a preponderance of the evidence standard. So that is enough. It is criminal enough. It is suspicious enough on its own to constitute reasonable suspicion. But this court needs...
Counsel, do you wish to keep going indefinitely, or you're over 3 minutes?
I didn't see that, Your Honor.
No problem.
Thank you for the reminder. I'll yield.
Thank you for your response to my question, Mr. Brown.
If you'll add 3 minutes to the appellant's time, please. Thank you.
Since I have a little bit of time, I'm going to try to make 4 points. I'll start with Curiam and why I do not think that decision is materially distinguishable. The government talks about anecdotes. That's what you had in the initial testimony here. Trooper Seiler testified that he thought it was suspicious because that's not how he packed when he moved to college. That was his testimony. Now, the government tried to clean that up on cross, and what the trooper testified to was that that's not how he thinks or he sees people packing. Let's think about that. Now, the question here is whether the way in which the van was packed means that there's drugs in the cargo. Now, for the trooper's testimony that I don't think that's the way people pack when they move to mean anything, he would have to have had searched the cars, all of these moving cars, people moving, and determined, based on his experience, that the neatly packaged cars contain drugs, but the cars that were not neatly packaged didn't contain drugs. And if he could do that, then he could infer that neatly packaged moving vans have drugs and not neatly packaged moving vans don't. I mean, that is an anecdote, period, plain and simple. Karam, it controls this case. If you were to write a decision saying what Mr. Brown wants you to say, you would have to overrule that case.
Well, can I just stop?
Yes.
Hold on. Because I want to phrase it just slightly differently and get you to react to it.
Okay.
What Crom says is you can't look at neatly packed boxes and say, per se, that is drugs.
Yes.
You can't do that.
Yes.
But I hear their argument is that you can look at those boxes and compare it to the story, I'm moving and I'm going to Minnesota. And if those two don't add up, then you can rely on that for reasonable suspicion. Can you help me understand why that is incorrect?
Well, I don't know that that's incorrect, but there's nothing that distinguishes what happened in Karam, because Karam was a person moving in a van. I mean, the facts are so similar that
I understand the facts, but what the court says, I believe, is that you can't per se conclude from neat boxes that they contain drugs. That's what you can't do.
Yeah.
But I guess you just disagree with that reading of the case.
The facts are so distinguishable. I don't, or so similar. I don't know how you get around that.
Well, I'm just trying to get you to respond to the argument. The facts may be similar, but the problem that occurred in Karam did not happen here. Facts are similar, but what the court said about what was problematic was not the case in this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just repeating myself, so I don't think I have anything. I do want to also mention there was no follow-up here. In Lopez, this court just made the point, when you have these types of situations, the officer is supposed to follow up with questions. That was pretty much dispositive in Lopez. The officer didn't say anything here. One other point on this, Mr. Berg never used the term household items. That he never told the officer he had household items. That's just gone. That's not what happened. To the extent, Mr. Brown's position, he basically wants you to write a decision that you have to defer to officers, and that is not the law. You have to give due weight to inferences drawn by officers, but those inferences both have to be reasonable and credible. This court does not defer to a police officer. That's not the law. And to the extent reasonable suspicion is a low bar, it still exists and it's still powerful, and this court on numerous occasions has found that reasonable suspicion did not exist. It should do so here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel are excused. The case is